This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. Thanks for joining us. Later this hour, we're going to learn about a new research project that's just getting underway at Florida Gulf Coast University that's looking to see if it might be possible to use naturally occurring viruses called phages to control blue-green algae blooms. But first, the documentary film Toxic Puzzle tells the story of an ethnobotanist named Paul Cox who has spent years trying to track down links between toxins produced by blue-green algae and neurodegenerative disorders like ALS and Alzheimer's. It all started with a huge spike in the number of cases of what is called ALS Parkinsonism Dementia Complex among people living in Guam. Cox's research uncovered that locals had been consuming large amounts of a toxin called BMAA that had apparently bioaccumulated in large fruit bats that were a staple of their diet. The toxin was found in the fruits of cycad trees that the bats ate. Its source was found to be blue-green algae that lived in those trees' roots. This set off a chain of research that continues to this day into the possible health effects of long-term exposure to blue-green algae, also known as cyanobacteria, which Southwest Floridians have become increasingly familiar with in recent years. On today's show, we're going to talk with researchers who have worked with Paul Cox on this issue. I'm joined on the line by Dr. Deborah Mash. She is CEO and founder of Demarex, Inc. It's a clinical stage pharmaceutical development company based in Miami, and she's the lead researcher on a study that found signs of amyloid plaques like those found in the brains of Alzheimer's patients in the brains of beached dolphins, which also contained BMAA. Dr. Mash, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. We appreciate your time.
It's good to be speaking with you today.
And I'm also joined on the line by Dr. Larry Brand. He's a professor of marine biology and ecology at the University of Miami. His research has looked at cyanobacterial blooms and the occurrence of BMAA in South Florida aquatic food webs. Dr. Brand, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
And later this hour, we're going to hear from Dr. Walter Bradley to learn about his research looking to correlate long-term exposure to toxins, including but not limited to BMAA and the development of ALS. As always, we do invite you to join our conversation. The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU. Just use the hashtag GCL. So, Dr. Mash, let's start with your research that found the amyloid plaques in the brains of beached dolphins. Like I said in the opener, this all got started years ago by a guy named Paul Cox, right?
Yes, Dr. Cox came to us in Miami and gave us a lecture more than 10 years ago, and this started a collaboration with us at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. So Dr. Bradley was my chairman at the time, and I had a large laboratory that I ran there where we were studying various neurological diseases of the human brain, and I'm the former founder and director of the University of Miami Brain Endowment Bank, one of the largest postmortem collections of brains donated from people who suffer from dementia and ALS and other disorders of the central nervous system. And we got involved originally in BMAA research because Dr. Cox wanted us to see if we could detect the toxin in the brains of North Americans who had died with this disorder. And after setting those studies up in our laboratory and running studies for over almost 2 years, we published our first report where we were able to detect significant concentrations of BMAA in the brains that were collected at autopsy in both Alzheimer's disease and people who suffered from Lou Gehrig's disease or ALS. So this was provided us a clue that there may be some association of this toxin and the neurodegeneration that you see in the brain of these victims. What was interesting in our study is that we also looked at unaffected healthy control. So these were people who aged razor sharp into their eighth, ninth decade of life and had no dementia or other disorders of the central nervous system, and we only saw incidental detections. And then finally, we had another control group for comparison, and this was brain tissue from patients who suffered from the genetic disorder of Huntington's disease. And again, we only saw limited detections of BMAA. So this was our first study that was published, working with Dr. Cox and Dr. Bradley, trying to see if we could detect this and what the rates of detection would be.
So how did the idea to test the beached dolphins' brains come to you?
Well, that brings us into the next question. That brings us into my colleague who's on the phone with us today, mm-hmm. Dr. Larry Brand, who is a world's expert on cyanobacterial toxins. So the big question was, well, wait a minute, these are North Americans. What's the exposure? What is in our diet? Because we're not eating fruit bats, and from these animals in Guam, we don't have the same dietary habits as the Guamians who were affected with the disease. So where is this coming from? What could be the possible exposure? And so Dr. Brand and his colleagues at the Marine School had a biorepository, much like we had the biorepository of donated human brains. They had specimens of the marine food web. So this was very complicated. It was the bottom feeders, and Dr. Brand will comment on this, all the way up the food chain to, of course, sharks and dolphins, which are apex predators. So we started our first study, and Dr. Brand was the first author on that publication, which was a collaboration between his laboratory and my laboratory, where we did virtually, we were blinded to condition because no one in my group knew anything about the marine food web. So we simply ran the specimens that he gave us in the laboratory, and then we gave them back to Dr. Brand to break the blind. And when he did so, he said, look, here's the pattern. We're seeing biomagnification of the food chain. That work was presented actually at a dinner party at Dr. Bradley's house. And our colleagues from Sweden who were there attending one of the think tanks that Paul Cox organizes every year went back and did a similar study in the Baltic Sea, and they had the exact same finding, the same pattern that we had in the South Florida marine food web, except the concentrations were different. To be exact, we had higher concentrations off the South Florida coastline. So this was another very big piece of the puzzle, the toxic puzzle, as you stated at the beginning of the show, which then led to us to look at apex predators, including sharks and dolphins.
Hmm. Dr. Larry Brand, tell us just a little bit about your research into the presence of BMAA in the aquatic food web. How long back does that go? And would you have seen yourself winding up talking about, you know, autopsies of dolphin brains?
Right. No, I'm an ecologist, so my focus has been on the causes of these algal blooms here in Florida. You know, where are the nutrients coming from that generate these blooms of blue-green algae down in Florida Bay, Lake Okeechobee, down the Coosachie River, and so on? And I really wasn't focused on the toxins per se until I saw Deborah Mash's data on American brains. And like she said, I mean, these Americans are not eating these fruit bats from Guam, so you knew there had to be another source of BMAA. And, of course, the link there was the blue-green algae, which were living on the roots of the cycad trees in Guam. So I got with Deborah and said, you know, we could have, you know, BMA in these blooms of blue-green algae here in Florida. That could be a significant source. And so that's what led to our collaboration then. And like she said, we did find high concentrations of BMA in different parts of the food chain where these blooms occur. And in a few cases, even we found concentrations of BMA twice as high as what was found in the fruit bats of Guam.
Hmm. How long has this BMAA been on the radar of scientists in general? Is it relatively newly understood?
Well, Deborah could actually describe that better. I mean, it's initially, the toxin, BMA, was initially discovered after World War II when these conditions developed among the Chamorro people of Guam. But after long periods of research on that, I guess in the 50s and 60s, they sort of gave up on it. They couldn't figure out how enough BMA was getting into the brains of the Chamorro people of Guam because they didn't realize the connection with the fruit bats. And it was Paul Cox who actually figured out, I guess about 15, 20 years ago, figured out, that it was biomagnified up the food chain to the fruit bats. And it wasn't until about I guess it was about 10 years ago that I became aware of this. And, of course, again, you know, I looked at the food chain, and then, you know, we want to go to the very top of the food chain. And so bottlenose dolphins are at the top of the food chain. That's an endangered species, so you have to get a special permit to get tissue, brain tissue in this case, from these dolphins. But on the positive side, because it's an endangered species, every time they find a dead dolphin, they do a full autopsy to figure out what the cause of death is. And so... And so again, Deborah Mash, you know, I got the brain tissue and gave them to her, and she analyzed the BMA. And of the six dolphins we got from the Indian River Lagoon, one of them did not have BMA in its brain, and the autopsy showed it had been hit by a boat. The other five dolphins, the autopsy could not find any obvious cause of death, but they all had high concentrations of BMA in their brains, similar to the concentrations you find in human brains, of people who died of ALS or Alzheimer's. So, again, suggesting a link there.
Dr. Mash, how similar are dolphin brains to human brains?
Well, they're different, of course. I mean, they don't speak and they don't walk on land, so they're not identical. But they are, again, very, you know, smart and complicated brain structures that are have many of the topographic and functional similarities to humans. But I want to add a little bit back to what Dr. Brand said about the sort of history of BMA research and what. The original seminal discovery of this on Guam was linked to eating of cycad seeds. And there was a group who came in from the National Institutes of Health and looked at the dietary practice and decided that, well, yes, BMA was in the cycad seeds. And there was a study done in primates and monkeys by a Dr. Spencer, who is a world-renowned toxicologist, neurotoxicologist, who had a seminal discovery in 1987 when he published that monkeys fed high concentrations of this toxin developed motor system impairments that are seen in ALS. But the problem here, which is what Dr. Brand said, is that when they went back and they studied this more, they couldn't figure out how people could be exposed to those concentrations. So the whole hypothesis about BMA exposure fell out of favor. And it wasn't until Paul Cox went back to Guam and spent time living with people, and based on his ethnobotany background, he is kind of a legend, sort of like an Indiana Jones of ethnobotany, goes back in there and figures out that, well, it was the fruit bats who were eating the cycad seeds, and then you get this biomagnification up the food chain, and that's how they were getting exposure to high concentrations of BMAA, which then would be linked to pathology to the brain. Now, you shift back to what the question about dolphin brains and human brains and sharks. The thing about us is we're long-lived. Sharks and dolphins are long-lived. And if you look at sharks and dolphins, they have concentrations of BMAA that, as Larry said, are comparable to what we showed in postmortem human brain. But not only the BMAA, they also have methylmercury. And as many of your listeners may know, mercury, we're all exposed to mercury in our diet. Mercury is a toxin that we are exposed to, but the bad thing about it is when you combine mercury with BMAA, it's a 1-2 punch. And so lower, what that means is there's a synergistic effect that the BMAA and methylmercury together will cause more toxicity to certain types of neurons in the brain. And so what was unique in the dolphin study, and as you pointed out, you know, proximity is not causality. We can't infer causality, but what I believe this may be showing us is that, one, these animals may have had, they definitely had pathology similar to what we see in the human brain, and it's you know, when I say similar, obviously it's not absolutely identical to what we have in cases of dementia, nor would we expect it to be. But the fact that the pathology is there and that we can find beta amyloid, which accumulates in patients with dementia and also in ALS and other disorders of the central nervous system, then this might suggest that there would be a pathway to toxicity not only in animals that are beached, in the dolphins, but also in humans who may be suffering from dementia. We don't know that the beached animals were suffering from dementia, okay? We can't infer this because we can't test the dolphins to see their behavior. But it is a clue that makes us concerned. And as Larry said, the animal who was an accidental kill did not have the toxicity. So we need to have, one of the things that has to be done is replicate. We need a much larger cohort of animals to be studied from different parts of the world, and that's why the collaboration with investigators, marine biologists up in the Northeast who had beached animals, beached dolphins, we were able to confirm what Larry was able to provide in his seminal studies with us in Miami about the exposure risk to dolphins that came to, you know, accidental death or natural death that came to autopsy.
So another researcher who has worked on this issue with you both, who you've referred to, is Dr. Walter Bradley. He's professor and chairman emeritus in the Department of Neurology at the University of Miami School of Medicine. I chatted with him last Friday about his current research that's trying to correlate where people who develop ALS live and what they would have been exposed to while living there in as detailed and broad a scope as possible to try to determine if there's a correlation between exposure to certain things and developing ALS. Let's hear that conversation now. You were at that screening there in Fort Myers, and then there was the panel discussion afterwards. Have you done many of those sort of things with this movie?
I think three of them so far, yes. And it's a very well-done movie. I've seen this story for about 15 years of working with Paul Cox. So I've been watching it and taking part in many of these expositions with Paul.
What is it like? What would be the mood like in the room after that movie ends and the panel discussion begins? Because especially for like here in Southwest Florida, where we just went through that big blue-green algae incident last year, what is it like amongst the people who are asking questions? Sort of what's it feel like in there?
Well, most of the people who come to them are advocates. I mean, most of them are people who've been subjected to the effect of the blue-green algae on the East Coast. It's the blue-green algae on the West Coast. It's the people who've been subjected to the red tides, and most of the people are fairly riled up. So it's a fairly hot period of questioning.
So when did this nexus between cyanobacteria and the toxin that it contains, BMAA, first come across your radar?
So you've got to go all the way back to about 2003, 2004. And I've been working with ALS patients and trying to find what's the cause of ALS, because I've been looking after ALS patients for about 50 years and trying to find what's the cause of the disease and how can you treat it. And in about 2003, Paul Cox wrote a paper producing evidence that the Guam ALS epidemic may be related to cyanobacteria. It was a paper that came out of left field for many of us who were in the field of ALS. Guam had been an interesting example of very high incidence of ALS that all of us had picked up on from the beginning of the recognition that in 1945, when the American troops got back into Guam, that there were about 25% of the deaths that occurred in Guam were due to ALS, and that the frequency of ALS was something like 200 times the amount of what it was in the rest of the world. An enormously high frequency, and there had to be some cause of it, and the attention immediately turned to the CICAD, which was the staple of the tortillas and the food of the people of Guam at that time. And there were a variety of different possible toxins that were present in the seed of the cycad palm at that time that were recognized. And one of them was a substitute amino acid called BMAA. But the amount of BMAA that was present was thought to be just not sufficient to be able to produce the disease. But Paul Cox was able to show in these papers in 2003-2004 that the amount of BMAA was actually concentrated up the food chain and got into the fruit bats, and the people eat fruit bats, and it got in. He was able to show, he and his colleagues, that it got into the brains of patients who were dying with ALS, and got into the proteins of the brains of those patients. And it came from cyanobacteria that were in the roots of the cycad palms. So that was the linkage, and I invited Paul to come and come to Miami and give a talk on what he'd found in Guam. My colleague Deborah Mash and I then got to work on the brains that we had in Deborah Mash's brain bank and found that the brains of the ALS patients had BMAA in them. And we confirmed Paul's finding that the Alzheimer's brains also had BMAA in them, but not the control brains. And that got us started on trying to find where the BMAA came from. We got to work with Larry Brand. Larry had been working on cyanobacterial blooms in the South Florida ecosystem. And Larry was able to show that BMAA came from cyanobacteria in the Florida Bay and worked its way up the food chain. And we had a smoking gun then of BMAA coming from the cyanobacteria, coming into the crustaceans, coming into the fish, coming into the apex predators, and eventually, we think, coming, therefore, into the brains of the patients who had died with ALS in South Florida. So that was the work that we started doing in 2009, 2010, 2011.
So this, you've followed through this closely with Dr. Mash and Dr. Brand and others that were featured in that documentary about Paul Cox and this whole toxic puzzle thing. It seems, though, that there's a lot of... you hear correlation does not equal causation from other scientists. We've talked to people on the show, and it seems a lot of people are unwilling to draw the kind of link that I think that you guys are drawing. What do you guys say about that?
Well, you're absolutely right. It's very difficult to prove that somebody had died because of that. And there are steps along the way of correlation that get stronger and stronger as each piece of this puzzle fall into place. So the next piece of the puzzle, if you like, was the demonstration that if you feed BMAA to monkeys, to vervets, you can produce the pathological changes of Alzheimer's disease. And in the recent paper that we're in the final stages of producing, you can produce the changes of ALS in the spinal cords of these monkeys, so that we have shown that the BMAA can produce the disease in monkeys. And then the other parts of the puzzle are that if in fact people live close to lakes and water bodies that have cyanobacterial blooms, there is an increased frequency of ALS adjacent to those water bodies. Now, again, you can't prove that living close is the cause of that high frequency of ALS, but nevertheless, it's an indication of the risk. And that's really where you come down to the cyanobacterial blooms here in Florida, and what should the Department of Health be doing about this? Because they take the point that indeed these algal blooms produce acute toxins that are dangerous. The animals die if they go swimming in it. Humans can get skin rashes and acute gastrointestinal illnesses and so forth. It's dangerous to swim or dangerous to be exposed to those blooms, but there are long-term consequences. It's been shown that there is an increased incidence of, and this is chronic exposure, there's an increased incidence of liver cancer, liver cirrhosis, from living near to water bodies that have frequent algal blooms. As I said, we believe and have evidence to show that there is an increased incidence of ALS in people who are living close to water bodies with these blooms. So we think that it would be advisable that departments of health advise people to keep away from these algal blooms. And by and large, there's been resistance to making note of those correlations.
You know, when we were sort of at the peak of the offshore red tide bloom and the coastal, you know, along the river and estuary, we had the blue-green algae. One of the reporters, well, all the reporters here in town were trying to get the State Department of Health on the phone or to have a conversation about it, and they were not able to really get anybody to even talk about it.
No, that's right. I mean, I understand the difficulties. We are a state that relies upon tourism, and we don't want to spread the fact that we have things that are going to be deterrent to people coming down and wanting to spend their money in Florida here. But nevertheless, if you live here, you should be trying to keep away from the water that has these cyanobacterial harmful algal blooms on them.
So your current research is, if I can get this right, it's trying to correlate where people who develop ALS lived over the course of a long period of time, what they might have been exposed to, not just necessarily cyanobacteria, to try to create kind of a map of who's getting it and what they were exposed to. Is that a simple way to describe it?
Yes. ALS and all these neurodegenerative diseases are not just one single cause for each of these diseases. There are a multiplicity of different causes. There are clearly the results of exposure to many different environmental factors. One patient may develop their disease due to one cause, while another patient may develop their disease due to a totally different cause. And it's probably their genetic makeup, each individual's genetic makeup, that makes them susceptible to cause A, and to another person's makeup makes them susceptible to cause B. Trying to work that out is an enormously difficult problem, and that's the problem that we're faced with, and that's what we're trying to work out. Cyanobacteria may only be one piece of that puzzle, and that's what our research is about, yes.
Can you kind of describe it a little bit more detailed than the overview that I gave in terms of all the parts that you're trying to correlate and how it works?
So, yes, Centers for Disease Control has a national ALS registry. That registry has funding from Congress that is giving a number of centers, ours being one of them, grants to do research trying to find the cause of ALS and the environmental factors that give that cause. We've got a consortium of a number of different centers, including Dartmouth, including NIH, including the University of Miami, and including the University of Turin in Italy, that are putting together massive databases of patients, control subjects, and looking at their genetic characteristics. We're collecting DNA from all of these patients and all of these controls, and putting together the environmental exposures, where they live, what they're exposed to, what they've been exposed to over their lifetime, and putting all of these facts together into phenomenal-sized databases and correlating them all. The amount of information is terabytes of information, and we're doing all this with machine learning, trying to pick out those correlations that will tell us what genetic factors relate to what environmental factors in individuals that cause these diseases. In the next 3, 4, 5 years, we're hoping to be able to come up with answers that will lead us into ways that can prevent these diseases or treat these diseases. In fact, from this work on cyanobacteria, we're already in clinical trials. There is work that is looking at one way of treating the cyanobacterial toxin, BMAA, hopefully being able to slow down the progress of the diseases, ALS and Alzheimer's disease.
You know, throughout the Toxic Puzzle movie, they talk about the amino acid serine. Is that how you pronounce it?
That's correct, yeah.
Can you talk just a little bit about that? Describe what it is for our listeners and how it fits in.
So L-serine is one of the normal amino acids that makes up our proteins. BMAA, interestingly, gets misincorporated into proteins in the brain into the place that serine should normally be incorporated. And because it's not quite the structure of serine, in the protein, it causes the protein to get twisted and become tangled and then to become misfunctioning. And that makes the protein toxic. That process, that misfolding of the protein, can be prevented by larger amounts of the normal amino acid that ought to be in that position, L-serine. Interestingly enough, the serine has another function as well, or maybe several other functions, that can be protective of the damage that the BMAA is producing. And we are now doing these clinical trials in patients with Alzheimer's disease and ALS to see if, in fact, we can alter the progress of the disease, slow it down, alter the manifestations of the disease in patients with these diseases. And it takes a long time. It's taking about 2 to 3 years to be able to complete these trials. But at the end of the trials, we will know whether, in fact, we have altered the course of the disease. And L-serine is cheap. It doesn't cost the hundreds of thousands of dollars that some of these other drugs cost. And if it does, in fact, work, we will really have made a major dent in these horrible neurological diseases.
That was Dr. Walter Bradley. He's professor and chairman emeritus in the Department of Neurology at the University of Miami School of Medicine. We chatted last week. If you're just tuning in, we're exploring possible connections between exposure to toxins produced by blue-green algae and neurodegenerative disorders like Alzheimer's and ALS. I'm still joined live by Dr. Deborah Mash. She was the lead researcher on a study that found signs of amyloid plaques like those found in the brains of Alzheimer's patients in the brains of dolphins. I'm also joined by Dr. Larry Brand. He's a professor of marine biology and ecology at the University of Miami. His research has looked at cyanobacterial blooms and the occurrence of BMAA in the South Florida aquatic food webs. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, you can find us on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media, or on Twitter. We're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So Dr. Mash, let's talk about the amino acid that he referred to, the L-serine. How familiar are you with the research study that he alluded to?
We're very familiar with it. We were the ones who conducted the monkey study,
mm-hmm.
where we fed primates in the island of St. Kitts I had collaborators there who had the African green monkeys, or what are called vervets, and we designed a study, a collaborative study with Dr. Cox and a group of investigators from McGill University who had the primate colony. And in that study, what we did is we took those monkeys, which carry a what's called the APOE4 allele, which is a genetic risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. These animals don't develop the same pathology as we see in human brain cases of Alzheimer's disease, but they do start to accumulate amyloid with age. And what we did is we fed them BMAA, and some of the animals received a placebo, so they got basically a powder that was non-toxic. And other animals received L-serine, the amino acid that you mentioned. And still another group received BMAA with L-serine, and we were able to demonstrate that the L-serine conferred a protection to the animals against BMAA exposure. So in other words, they didn't develop as much of the pathology as we do see in monkeys fed BMAA over time.
Do you take L-serine supplements?
I take amino acids and that contain L-serine routinely. I have for many, many decades in my life. I'm definitely into nutritional health, and I'm also very careful about having a diet that's not too heavily weighted in any direction. So in other words, I limit my protein sources. I don't eat a lot of shellfish routinely, and after we, you know, studied up on BMAA, I eat even less. And I'm careful about, you know, eating more vegetables and fruits in my diet and healthy grains.
Dr. Brand, has your research, like what Dr. Mash was just saying, in any way changed your behavior?
Yes, I eat a lot less seafood now. I'll eat a little bit of fish from, you know, offshore salmon and tuna, because, you know, you don't get these blooms of blue-green algae offshore. These blooms are, you know, limited to inshore and freshwater places and so on. And again, we saw a higher concentration of BMAA in benthic animals like shrimp and crabs, so I avoid that. And I avoid shellfish for a number of reasons. So, yeah, I've altered my I think I had a fairly healthy diet to begin with, eating very little meat to begin with, and I've just carries a little bit further now, being aware of the potential exposure to BMAA.
Where are you at with your research in this field right now, Dr. Brand?
Well, based upon the fact that, you know, you see this high association between these diseases and people who live near lakes that get these blooms of blue-green algae, you know, initial assumption was, well, maybe the people who live near the lakes are eating more fish from the lake. But that may or may not be true. But the other thing is that what they're certainly doing is breathing more of the air coming off that lake. And so, I mean, what we know right now is, you know, you really don't want to go swimming in the water where you have these blooms. You really don't want to eat the seafood coming out of the water where these blooms are. And you can, you know, make that choice. But what you can't do, if you live next to, say, the Kootsatchie River or something like that, you can't help but breathe the air. And what we don't know yet is to what extent the toxins produced by these blue-green algae can make it into the air. Now, by contrast, people there along the West Coast well know that the toxin produced by the red tide, a toxin called bravotoxin, that is well known to get into the air. It actually causes a lot of health problems for people there along the West Coast. And so that's been well researched. But what we don't know is to what extent these toxins produced by blue-green algae make it into the air. And that's what we're working on right now.
Gotcha.
If that's a health risk as well. What we do know is this past summer when you had these blooms in the Fort Myers, Cape Coral area, a lot of people did get sick, and they're contributing it to the blue-green algae blooms. And I guess it was 3 years ago when we had the famous guacamole blooms of blue-green algae in the Stewart area in the St. Lucie estuary. The same thing. A lot of people got sick. So, and they, you know, these people were not swimming in the water, and they were not eating seafood out of it. So, you know, sort of indirectly, it does suggest that some of these toxins are getting into the air. So that's what we're focusing on right now.
All right. And Dr. Mash, we only have about a minute and a half left, but real quickly, what's next for you and your research?
Yeah. Well, as Dr. Bradley mentioned, we're getting ready to publish our studies on looking at the spinal cord of the primates, of the monkeys that were fed the BMAA. And I'm going to be meeting with a local foundation that's very interested in what Dr. Brand just talked about, whether or not we may be getting exposures not only through the air that we breathe, but also through the water that we drink.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for this part of the show. I want to thank my guests. Dr. Deborah Mash is CEO and founder of Demarex, Inc., a clinical stage pharmaceutical development company based in Miami. And she was the lead researcher on a study that found signs of amyloid plaques like those found in the brains of Alzheimer's patients in the brains of dolphins. She's also done a whole lot of other stuff, and I hope to have her back on the show someday. Dr. Mash, thank you for your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And thanks also to Dr. Larry Brand. He's a professor of marine biology and ecology at the University of Miami. His research has looked at cyanobacterial blooms and the occurrence of BMAA in South Florida aquatic food webs. Dr. Brand, thanks for your time as well.
You're welcome.
And when we return, we're going to learn about new research just getting underway at Florida Gulf Coast University into the possibility of using viruses to control blue-green algae blooms. I'm Mike Canary. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.